Hi there, everyone. I'm Lori Boyer. If I haven't met you, I want to meet you. I'm president-elect of NAFB. Welcome to our session this afternoon. It's the Alternative Crops Panel. We'll have Michael Bowman and Dr. Rob Myers on a panel this afternoon. With us today to introduce our panelists is Matt Merritt with POET, and we appreciate his sponsorship of this session. Matt?
Thank you, Lori. I'll give you guys 2 minutes about who we are, and then we'll get on to the stars of the show here. But I am Matt Merritt. I'm with POET. We're the world's largest biofuel producer, based out of Sioux Falls, but we have plants in seven straight states spread across the Midwest. Here to talk about a few things, and we'll be available at Booth 5 and Trade Talk. One of those being the current challenges in agriculture and how biofuels can play a role in helping turn some of those problems around, some of those economic challenges that we're seeing right now. Related to that is E15 and President Trump's recent announcement that he made just last month that his administration was gonna push forward with year-round sales of E15. That's really gonna be one of those vehicles for growth in not only biofuels, but then related to that in commodities in general, who can help support that growth. Besides that, we got a couple new products. We got a new pellet product that we're getting into cow-calf and bison operations, some other things like that that might be of interest to you. And if you're interested in any of this, you can catch me later, or I'll be at Trade Talk tomorrow, Booth 5, all morning long. So hope to see you guys there. So moving on to the topic of the day here. Lori had the easy job because my resume fits on a Post-it note. And these guys is definitely is not. Excited to hear about everything that our two distinguished guests have to say today, though. Alternative crops are such a neat area, and POET, as a leader in cellulosic biofuel development, we're always interested in hearing about some of the work that's being done on some of these alternative crops that could be sources for that in the future. So first we have, on the far left here, Michael Bowman. A passionate hemp advocate, Michael Bowman is a fifth generation native of rural Colorado and has dedicated his life to key agrarian issues both nationally and internationally. He authored Section 7606 of the 2014 Farm Bill, granting for the first time in decades the right to cultivate hemp under federal law in states where hemp production is legal. On July 4th, 2013, he orchestrated the hemp flag used for the House floor debate to be flown over the U.S. Capitol. Bowman's pioneering work includes inaugural member of the Colorado Industrial Hemp Commission, founding board chair of the National Hemp Association, and a founding member of 25 by 25 and the Sustainable Biodiesel Alliance. Additionally, he serves on the board of the North American Industrial Hemp Council and serves as chair of the Hemp for Victory 75th Anniversary Campaign. As a member of the White House Champions of Change program in 2011, he met with President Obama in 2012. He attended the University of Arkansas and is a graduate of the Colorado Agriculture and Rural Leadership Program. He was a Next Generation Fellow in Columbia University's American Assembly and a recipient of Colorado State University Gamma Sigma Delta's Significant Achievement in Agriculture Award. Next, we have Dr. Rob Myers. Dr. Rob Myers is a regional director of extension programs for the USDA NIFA North Central Region Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program. He administers competitive grants and state funding for sustainable agriculture projects in 12 North Central states. He also holds an appointment as an adjunct faculty member in the Plant Sciences Division at University of Minnesota, where he is based.
Missouri.
University of Missouri. He told me not to say Kansas, but I went and said Minnesota. Plant Sciences Division at the University of Missouri, where he's based. His professional expertise encompasses sustainable agriculture, crop diversification, and conservation, with a particular focus on cover crops and soil health. He has conducted numerous research and education programs on alternative crops, including alternative grains, oilseeds, and legumes, and has also done significant work on cover crops. His PhD in agronomy is from University of Minnesota.
There's Minnesota.
There you go. And he grew up on a family grain farm in central Illinois. So he's been all over the Midwest. Yep. And with that, I'll turn it over to our guests.
Thank you.
All right.
Well, I'm going to come around here so I can actually see the same thing you're seeing on the screen. And if you have a question as I'm going along, it's happy to take a quick question, but I know we're going to have a lot of time after our presentations for a panel discussion. So Michael and I will definitely be prepared to interact with you in that way. So I've got about 16, 18 minutes of material I'm going to go through just to kind of set the context for what's out there in terms of alternative crops that farmers can be looking at. And of course, the interest now, like so many previous times in history, is with the low commodity prices. In fact, I've started working with alternative crops about 30 years ago, right after I finished my PhD, and that was an era of relatively low prices. And clearly, as you'd expect, whenever we have low prices for corn, soybeans, and wheat, that is when interest starts to spike in alternatives, very understandably, because people are looking for things they can make some money on. But the neat thing is that these things provide potential not just for income, but also other things they can do for us. So I'll talk a bit about that. I did grow up on a corn and soybean farm, so I fully appreciate the value of our commodities. We raised wheat for times too. But at the same time, there's a world of potential among the alternative crops that are out there. So again, I'm going to touch on a variety of things just briefly, be happy to go more in depth during our Q&A, and I know Michael will dive into a more specific example with hemp. So first of all, I wanted to just touch on why even look at alternative crops beyond the obvious economic aspects. And then I thought I'd just touch briefly on a few different areas of alternatives. We can look at things like alternative oil seeds. There's also things we'd call specialty crops that maybe fit more into the fruit, vegetable, nut type of opportunity. There are opportunities with niche versions or specialty versions of some of our commodities. There's new interest in perennial grains, particularly Kernza. I'll briefly touch on that. And then I want to end up with what I think is one of the best opportunities for farmers that have commodity crop equipment, which is to grow cover crop seed. And I'll explain why I think that's such a new opportunity for farmers across the country. So first of all, one way I think about this, and I've had a chance to work with probably 70 different alternative crops, at least on a limited basis, some much more in depth, is that there are a lot of benefits from plant diversity. Again, there's clearly the economic aspect of this. Can we find something that will make more money? But when we think of the way our soils evolved, they evolved with diverse species of plant communities growing on them. So this is a picture of a prairie, but we could think of a forest in the same way. And when we have those diverse plant communities, that has an impact on what's happening below the soil in terms of the soil ecosystem. So I know many of you have written stories about soil health. That's certainly a very hot topic among the farming community today, something I spend a lot of time working with folks on. And as we have learned more about what's happening in the soil, there's really a world down there that is kind of unseen to us other than maybe earthworms. So we're learning, for example, that with the plant roots, regardless of what type of plant we're growing, whether that's a row crop, forage, or something else, that those plant roots are exchanging carbohydrates with things like fungi and bacteria that are in turn providing nutrients back to the plant roots. Those organisms, in turn, are being fed on by other things like protozoa, nematodes, and you've got arthropods, earthworms, all kinds of organisms that are part of that food chain. So the simple takeaway is that the more diversity we have, either as part of a rotation or multiple plants growing at a time, the more that helps with soil health, one of the goals that we're learning to put more attention to. Coming back to the plant side, given POET is sponsoring this, you know, it's very appropriate to think about the uses of a lot of these crops. One thing I've learned over the years is as we diversify the plants we're working with, that opens up a world of possibilities in terms of end markets. It's really remarkable how many different uses we can get on out of so many of our plants. We're all familiar with corn and soybeans, the uses they have. You're going to hear about hemp, some of the amazing different uses that has. But all of these crops have varieties of different chemicals in them that create potential for different markets. And one of those big markets that continues to grow out there is in the oil seed area. Of course, in the US, we think primarily of soybean, but there are obviously many other oil seeds that are out there, and several of them can be grown quite successfully across much of the US. If we look at the trend line, a big interest has been in healthier oils, So gradually, soybeans have been bred to kind of change the fatty acid profile. But we also have things like sunflower and canola that inherently have fairly healthy oils, and even those have had plant breeding to improve them. Again, coming back to bioenergy, there's potential with all of these for biodiesel or other uses, including biolubricants. So I wanted to touch just on two as examples, sunflowers and canola. So sunflowers is one that I've worked with farmers a lot on. We've had quite a few farmers all around the Midwest growing these, of course, mostly in the northern plains. And I always point out that among all of our commodity crops, if you think about crops that we grow, let's say, a million acres or more of, the only one of those that's native to the United States is sunflowers. So you think of corn coming from Mexico, soybeans from China, rice from Southeast Asia, wheat from the Near East. All of those other crops are from somewhere else in the world. So that gives sunflowers some inherent advantages. It's well adapted to our soils and climate. It can shrug off a lot of the pests that we have. And when we think about, again, having things that work well with our soils to improve them, there's a lot of benefits to growing something that is native, like sunflowers. As we look across the country, sunflowers are one of our more versatile crops. They're fairly cold tolerant, so they can be planted early in the spring, but they're also very tolerant of heat and dry conditions, so they can be planted in this region as a double crop after wheat. In Missouri, we see both of those approaches to growing sunflowers, and they're relatively shorter season than something like soybeans. The driving interest, of course, has been in them as an oil, about twice the oil content of soybeans. There are actually many sunflower varieties on the market. Not everybody realizes this. If you look just at the commercial sunflower hybrids, there are probably close to 100 hybrids that have been released in the last 20 years. Many of those are what we would call new sun types that are mid-oleic. And the higher the level of oleic acid, that gives you certain properties, such as for cooking uses. It makes for a stable cooking oil for making like potato chips in. If we wanted to use certain high oleic types, those are available. We're now seeing semi-dwarf types, if that's of interest to farmers. We do know that sunflowers, along with a lot of other crops, provide rotation benefits. If you add a third crop to a corn and soybean rotation, you can actually boost the yield of corn and soybeans by putting that third crop into the rotation, because it's breaking up some of the disease cycles. It's helping with soil health, may affect some of the insect pests, such as corn rootworm. So that's an advantage. Sunflowers in particular, we know, are deep rooting, and they're deeper rooting than corn and soybeans would be. So when you grow them in a rotation with corn and soybeans, those crops will root more deeply, which can be an advantage. There are opportunities for farmers to direct package these for birdseed and direct market. You might not think that that's that big of a market, but about probably 10 years ago, I looked into the size of the U.S. birdseed market for just sunflowers, and it was 700,000 acres a decade ago, and I'm sure it's only grown since then, because I certainly see more birdseed as I go into stores over recent years. So that's a huge market. It's about a third of the sunflowers that are grown have gone into the birdseed market traditionally, and it creates an opportunity for farmers to direct market. And again, I just emphasize our only major commodity that's native to America. How about canola? Even though this one is not native to America, it comes out of Europe. You know, it is one that works in many parts of the country. We have spring and winter types available. Of course, many of you have seen either pictures or driven by fields of canola, but very colorful when it's blooming. This is a shot here near here in late April, a very colorful crop. In the fall, it's going to look like this. One of the things I like it about it is a winter annual crop with the winter types is it provides good ground cover. So here's wheat next to it that does not cover the soil as completely. And one thing we can do with canola, and some farmers in Missouri are starting to do this, is we can come in and graze it. So around this time or through December, farmers can do some grazing on the canola and then let it regrow for harvest or just use it as a cover crop. So why canola more specifically? Again, high oil content, about double the content of soybean oil, just like sunflowers. A lot of new varieties have come onto the market, both of the spring and winter types. So we have winter hardy types. We have types that have herbicide resistance. And we also see crop rotation benefits with canola. For example, the brassicas that canola is part of the family of, they have biofumigant abilities, so that can help deal with certain diseases in the soil, can help reduce populations of nematodes in some cases. It can also work pretty well to double crop with a crop like soybeans. Depending on where you grow it, it can mature a little earlier the winter wheat. That gives us more time to grow the soybeans, and as I said, can be crazed. So those are just some brief information about two widely adapted alternative crops that I think we're going to continue to see growth in acreage. Right now, they're both roughly 2 million acre crops in the U.S. I would mention about canola that we actually import more than we're growing because of the demand. We aren't growing enough to meet the demand in the U.S., so there's certainly an opportunity there. Well, what about higher value specialty crops? One of the challenges with something like sunflowers and canola is they can be a little more profitable than corn and soybeans, but it depends on where you're at for your market. So we do see a lot of farmers nowadays growing higher value specialty crops. This is a photo I took on a farm in Iowa. He was growing several acres of vegetables, had a large variety of chili peppers that he was growing. I've seen on farms that I visit, and that's one of the fun aspects of my job, I get to visit a lot of farms all over the country. I've seen farmers doing creative things like taking native grapes right out of the woods. This is a farm in southeastern North Dakota. This farmer went out into the woods, selected some grapevines, created a very nice vineyard from them, which I didn't know you could do that with native grapes. And now he's selling them. He doesn't have his own wine processing facility on his farm, but he sells to a winemaker. He's in North Dakota, the winemaker's in South Dakota. And I looked up, the bottles of native wine were selling for $50 a bottle, $50 a bottle. So that's pretty profitable if you can sell enough of them. So that was interesting to see, but certainly a lot of vineyards out there. We're also seeing more and more farmers doing local vegetables, specialty markets in that area. I think of just in Missouri, over the last decade, we probably tripled the number of small acreage farmers growing vegetables for the local to market, given the demand for local foods. This is Curtis Millsap down near Springfield, Missouri. I was just on his farm, took this photo about a month ago, and he was producing, I think, about 50 different kinds of vegetables. One thing he was doing that a lot of these farmers do is season extension. There is assistance from like NRCS. You can get assistance to do high tunnels if you're transitioning to organic. And in his case, he was using the high tunnels to do things like cherry tomatoes that were a higher value type product. So I think that's one of the ways, even some grain farmers are doing this now to add income to their operation. I've also been on farms where people aren't just growing food plants, they're growing ornamentals such as cut flowers, botanicals for the herbal market. So lots of different specialty opportunities, but a lot of it comes back to marketing. And we'll probably talk more about that in the Q&A. Yet another area of specialty crops is what we might call the agroforestry type of things. We've got a farmer in west central Missouri who's a grain farmer who's added to his farm for extra income chestnuts and elderberries. And there are new varieties of chestnuts. There are crosses with Chinese chestnuts that are pretty productive. So you can see the fruit starting to form here. And then with the elderberries, they flower early in the season. You can actually sell the flowers or you can sell the fruit. Interestingly, I saw on Monday on USA Today's website, on their front page of the website, they had a paid article on elderberries by, I think, a company called Nature's Way. And I was a little interested to see that they were advertising elderberries out of Europe. So here's something we can grow that's actually native across much of the U.S., these elderberries, and so we are seeing more farmers starting to grow those as a potential high-value specialty crop. Well, what about our commodities farmers already have equipment for? Things like corn and soybeans. There's obviously lots of specialty varieties of these. One I particularly wanted to mention is edamame soybeans, because these are getting more popular in the food market, and yet again, we're sometimes importing these. You've probably had edamames either at a restaurant or maybe as part of a frozen vegetable mix. I know the frozen vegetables we usually get, they're just part of the mix that we get. But there are differences in varieties and taste. I've done variety trials with edamame soybeans, and we've done taste trials, and sure enough, depending on what you're growing, some of them taste better, some not so much. Seed costs can be a little high, so that's a little something to overcome. But the bigger issue is harvesting and storage. So we see some smaller acreage vegetable farmers growing them as a hand harvest crop, similar to green beans, but we also see some farmers doing it on a commercial scale, typically using a green bean picker. You just have to take it into refrigeration like any other high moisture vegetable crop or freeze it pretty quickly to be able to keep it stored. But that's one, just as an example again, where a farmer can use some of their existing planting equipment. They just have to think about harvesting differently than they would with the dried soybeans. Okay, what about a whole different type of alternative crop? If we think about all of our grains that we grow, they're all annuals, either spring annuals or winter annuals. But this is intermediate wheatgrass or kernza. You may have seen some articles about this. This has been in the media quite a bit in the last couple of years. For example, there was a Food and Wine magazine article last year. General Mills is making a big bet that kernza is the grain of the future. And I know they've put a few million dollars over the last several years in supporting work on kernza. The original work on kernza was actually done just to our west a couple of hours in Salina, Kansas at the Land Institute, a nonprofit there. They've worked with several universities, including my alma mater, University of Minnesota, to develop this crop. And as an agronomist, I would say it looks pretty good agronomically. It stands up about 3 feet tall. You plant it once, and then you're going to harvest it several years in a row without having to replant it. Doesn't seem to need much in the way of fertility. Seems to have few pest problems, very good nutrition. The only two things holding it back right now are seed supply and the fact that the yield is not as high as our traditional wheat varieties, because again, there's been relatively little breeding so far. But they're making rapid progress with yields, and so I think this is an up-and-coming product. Of course, it can be used in any of the things that regular wheat is used in, such as breads. Patagonia actually made a type of beer with it called Long Root Ale, and that's coming from the fact that as a perennial grass, it has a very deep root system. So here's traditional wheat, maybe has a 3 to 4 foot root system depending on the soils, and this was roots that they dug up in Salina, Kansas, 2 hours west of here, and the intermediate wheatgrass or kernza had roots over 10 feet long and much bigger root mass to begin with. So that's excited a lot of people. I guess there's even a restaurant out in Portland where they have this picture mounted horizontally in the restaurant, and they call it the Perennial is the name of the restaurant, and they sell a lot of kernza products there. So anyway, something that may take hold more in the future. So how are we going to use these perennials? Well, we could plant whole fields of them like we normally do with wheat. One thing I envision, and I know others are interested in, is can we use them as buffer strips in our regular agricultural landscape? So Iowa State University has seen if we put in buffer strips of perennial grasses, maybe taking 10% of the landscape, that that can really reduce erosion and runoff of nutrients. The problem, of course, is we're losing economic value when we do that if we're just putting prairie plants out there. So if we could put something like kernza in that we could either harvest for grain or graze or hay, then that would be a value. And you can, in fact, hay or graze kernza. It has some good forage value. Another way to get value out of a landscape like this is to grow a cover crop in between those buffers in the off season. So you can see some terraces here that have more regular perennial grasses on them, cool season grasses, and then cover crops in between. And we're finding that this dramatically lowers the erosion, as you'd expect, up to 98% of the erosion and reduction in nutrient runoff. I wanted to kind of switch at this point to talking about the cover crop market because it is such a big changing thing. So one of the things I've done through my office is run a national farmer survey on cover crops, and we did 5 years of that survey. And this is one of the figures we saw from the most recent survey a year and a half ago in terms of the growth in acreage of the 1,500 or so farmers reporting data on their acreage. So if you go back to 2012, they said they had about, on average, 200 acres of cover crop per farm. And by 2016, they were up to 400 acres. And this survey was done in the spring of 2017. They projected that fall they would continue to increase their acreage. So a pretty steady growth of around 15%. And in earlier surveys, we went back to about 2008, very similar trend line. So if we continue that trend line, and no trend line goes straight forever, right? But in theory, that would continue up to maybe get to about 50 million acres in not too distant future by 2025. And this is at a 13% growth rate instead of a 15% growth rate. So the only thing we know for sure is that in 2012, we were at 10.3 million acres. That was the USDA Census of Ag. Of course, we've got the new Census of Ag after the fall of 2017. We'll get that data next spring. But I and others have estimated that we're probably somewhere between 17 and 20 million acres of cover crops now. And so again, even though this trend line probably won't continue exactly the same, we could be getting to 40 to 50 million acres of cover crops. So we're seeing certainly more of them out in the landscape. In Missouri alone, we had close to $20 million in cost share incentive for cover crops this year, probably second highest in the nation. But we still have a lot of farmers who are only putting part of their farm and the cover crops. So this is that same survey. 32% of the farmers had 20% of their land or less in cover crops, and only another quarter had 80% or more. But there's a lot of the farmers who are partway in between there. So about half had 40% or less. So just the farmers that are already committed to cover crops provide a lot of growth potential. And I just take as an example, not too far north of here, Ray Gasser, who was president of the American Soybean Association a couple years ago. He farmed 6,000 acres of corn and soybeans. He started with like 100 acres of cereal rye. And last time I talked to him, he was up over 3,000 acres, and he's hoping to get the whole farm planted to cover crops. So just an example of how adoption's increasing. Sometimes you hear people say, well, there's only 5 or 10% cover crops in my state, but we know we can get higher adoption. This is southeast Pennsylvania, Lancaster County. I was sent several aerial photos from different parts of the county, and at first I thought, well, that's just winter wheat. But I looked at the USDA statistics, and only 3% of that county is winter wheat for grain. And I've confirmed from a few people, yes, that's all cover crops, except for a couple pasture fields there, and all the pictures were that way. They have, they believe, around 70% adoption in that part of Pennsylvania of cover crops on corn and soybean ground. You go into Maryland, also over half of the land in cover crops. So I'm not suggesting the whole Midwest is going to look like that in the next couple of years, but we know that higher adoption rates are possible. And one of the things that will drive that, I believe, is the issue with herbicide-resistant weeds. We know that these are becoming a bigger and bigger problem across the U.S. They've moved out of the south, across most of our row crop growing areas. So here's Palmer amaranth, and I've noticed myself just driving around the Midwest, more and more of these fields, they're becoming a problem. In our survey, again, looking back to the summer of 2016, almost 60% of the farmers said they had herbicide-resistant weeds on their farms, and this is a nationwide survey. So that was higher than I expected, and again, that's increasing every year. So we asked, what are the cover crops doing for you? Well, it's not a perfect solution. Only 25% said that cereal rye always helped with herbicide-resistant weeds, but another big chunk, 44%, said sometimes they help, and then about a third said that they weren't seeing a specific response to it. So it's a tool in our toolkit. It's not the sole solution, but it's one of the driving forces with cover crops. So why is this going to become big as an alternative crop? Well, there's a lot of different cover crops that are being grown. We think of cereal rye. It is the big one. It's sometimes called the queen of cover crops, grown on about half of the total acres based on our national survey. There's lots of other cover crops. There's about a dozen listed here, and there's actually over 30 species of cover crops sold through different farm seed companies today. And so if you extrapolate these out, there's quite a few million acres. Some of them are being grown in mixes. In fact, about half of our cover crop use are in mixes as opposed to sole species. So what does that mean as far as the size of the cover crop seed industry? Again, I mentioned we're getting close to 20 million acres of cover crops now. And if not, we'll be there in the next year or two. And by 20 to 25, barring major economic disruptions of that, I would expect we'll be up in that 40 to 50 million acre range in the next 7 years, based on current trends. So if you take our survey national average of $25 of seed per acre, that's a $1 billion seed industry that we'd have within the next 7 years. And we're halfway there now, so a $500 million industry as of right now. So to sell that seed for 40 million acres, because we've got to kind of be ready for that, that's going to take 1 million acres of cover crop seed production. That's 1 million acres in cover crop seed production we didn't have a decade ago, and we're only doing half that much right now. So there's clearly a big opportunity for farmers there. I'd also point out we have probably about 50,000 farmers in the U.S. growing cover crops now, and depending on how you assume the acreage will grow, will it be these farmers adding more or new farmers getting into it? But I would estimate we could be close to 100,000 farmers growing them within 7 years. So that's a lot of new farmers to sell cover crop seed too, and to work with. And driving this is going to be not only herbicide-resistant weeds, but new measurements of soil health, demand for sustainably produced foods. General Mills, Cargill, Walmart, they're all asking about, can we have farmers do sustainable practices like cover crops? And then interest in how does this affect my profitability going forward? So in terms of seed opportunities, the thing I want to give you a takeaway on is that we can't grow all cover crop seed everywhere in the country. So one of our popular cover crops is radishes, and this is a photo I took, maybe not too easy to see with the lights, but got white flowers in the spring. I took this in Oregon back in May. They can grow radishes very well in Oregon. In fact, they grow a lot of our seed that we use across the country of forages, and turf grasses, and other crops. If we tried to grow that in Missouri or Kansas, we can grow it for seed here, but we would not have nearly as good a yields as they do in Oregon, and we'd have more problems with pests than they do. On the other hand, this is a variety trial of rye. Here's Elbon that was developed in Oklahoma in the middle. And we can grow rye across many of our commodity growing areas. In fact, many farmers are doing that. I've talked to several farmers who that's been their most profitable crop in recent years is growing cereal rye for the cover crop seed market. So I do think that this is going to continue to be an alternative for row crop farmers. And again, there's a lot of different cover crops that can be grown. So bottom line, wrap up and turn this over to Michael. For cover farmers seeking alternative crops, we want to get the right fit for their rotations, their equipment, and labor. We want to identify the markets. One thing I've certainly learned as an agronomist, that half the battle with alternative crops is getting the markets figured out. And then, again, thinking about adding diversity to the farm, not just for economic purposes, but also soil health, and that, in turn, hopefully, will lead to some greater farm wealth. So I'll be happy to answer questions, but if there's nothing real quick, we'll get it turned over and have the presentation on hemp, and then we'll have our panel discussion.
Okay.
So let me try to get your slides.
There we go. All right. Well, good afternoon, everybody. Sorry, I'm on the back end of a cold, so I may cough a couple of times, but bear with me. My name is Michael Bowman. As Lori said, I grew up on a farm in eastern Colorado. And by happenstance, back in 2001, when I was sitting around a campfire in Zimbabwe doing some work with Alan Savory on grass management, we run across an Australian couple who were talking about this transition from hemp to cotton. Back in India at the time, and I got really enthralled with what was happening, the dynamics that was going on in India with that transition, and as such started studying the crop, basically as a transition crop to it was a very personal thing for me, a transition crop for what we might look at in eastern Colorado, as you know, where our farm, as many others, are situated over the Ogallala Aquifer. We could foresee the challenges we were going to have with water and the battles with Kansas and Nebraska over the water that's running down the Republican River, and knew at that time with an interest I had in rural development that what we needed to start identifying crops that might give us an opportunity to maybe save water, grow some jobs, and just generally do something better than what we're doing right now with our corn production in that Ogallala region. So I started my hemp journey 17 years ago, and if somebody would have said it's going to take you 17 years to get to where we are today, I probably wouldn't be here today. But one success begets another. And fascinating to me, the fact that being in Colorado, we were far enough west that hemp was never grown before we went into the Prohibition period. But to find out, A, why it was prohibited, what it could have been, the trajectory we were on as a country, really towards a bioeconomy back in 1937 with what Henry Ford had envisioned as a bioeconomy, just pre-World War II, and how we moved off into a hydrocarbon economy. So for me, it was this interesting mix of policy gone bad and how do we fix it. And much like the work we did with 25 by 25, which was kind of intertwined with my work in hemp during that period of time, how do we take kind of some bold ideas, in those cases renewable energy or bringing an old a prohibited crop back? How do we educate the public? How do we take 80 years of myths and lies and bust them up and turn it into good public policy so we can create new opportunities for our farmers? So on my journey we went. I didn't know this before Dr. Meyer's work, but that center picture was a picture of me 30 years ago. We were one of the first sunflower growers in Colorado, and we did that to break a rotation to deal with our jointed goat grass in our winter wheat crops in eastern Colorado, we were just wheat fallow, and there wasn't anything that would solve it. Sunflower solved our problem, and so we had a great run with that and bringing that into Colorado. So that was 30 years ago. And so here we are today, you know, looking at hemp opportunities for our farmers. Now, this has been a policy journey for me. We started really in Colorado educating and realizing that all politics are local. And the best way to create a federal policy is to create a good state policy. A good state policy usually starts with something local as well. So we started educating people quarterly in the Denver area at the Canadian Consulate, as they were the last country that had legalized industrial hemp, and had opened up their offices to us to work on this education process with us. They were great partners in doing all that. And so from 2006 to 2010, we did a massive education campaign in Colorado, and then went to our legislature, got resolutions in support of, passed a small bill in spring of 2012 to do some phytoremediation with hemp. Hemp's a great bioaccumulator and a great way to clean up soils. And then in 2012, we passed Colorado's Amendment 64, we became the first state to, and actually the first unit of government in the world to end prohibition in its entirety on the cannabis plant. So in our Constitution is embedded both the right for our farmers to cultivate industrial hemp and then for adult use as well. So we became the first state to do so. Today, there are 40 states. I'm going to go ahead and come back. There are 40 states that are legal, and that has happened over this 5-year period. But if you look at the fall of 2012, then hemp is legal in Colorado. We move into the spring of 2013 and June of 2013, where the process with the current farm bill language exists right now. But a little history before I go there on that. Hemp played a really critical role in the development of our early days of our country. And in fact, in colonial America, if you were a farmer with more than 10 acres, you were required to grow to set aside 10% of your land for hemp production, for both fiber and textiles and paper, and you could pay your taxes in hemp as well. In 1862, we had 16 million acres of hemp being grown in the United States, according to the U.S. Census. In 1937, Popular Mechanics declared that the hemp would be the next billion-dollar crop in the United States. We were just on the verge of some mechanization and finding ways to really put some efficiency into that supply chain. Henry Ford had already developed his hemp car, his hemp plastic car, that he envisioned would be run on hemp biofuels. He envisioned a car that was grown from the soil and ran from the soil, and at that time, he also had his Iron Mountain biorefinery, and where he was using extensive amounts of hemp oil for industrial lubricants. And at that time, the Sherwin-Williams paint base was all hemp oil. So we were moving down this path. Enter prohibition in 1937. On August 2nd, 1937, thanks to some backroom dealings with some barons business barons at the time, the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937 was put in place. And at that time, it wasn't prohibited to grow, but you were required to pay such an enormous tax that the farmers just stopped growing it. And so through that period from 1938 to the Controlled Substances Act in 1970, very little hemp was grown, with the exception of World War II and the Hemp for Victory campaign, which started in 1942. Every 4-H club in Kentucky was given enough seed to grow 2 acres for seed multiplication. And in that following year, that seed was used across 7 states for farmers who planted hundreds of thousands of acres of hemp for the war effort. Our Congress created a War Hemp Industries Corporation, which built 43 processing plants across the United States. Those lasted, generally were in full production for a couple of years. When the war was over, the support for the domestic industry stopped, and they returned it back to importing our hemp, basically from the Philippines in that area. And so it wasn't until 1969, when the Controlled Substances Act was put in place, that Richard Nixon decided that industrial hemp should be combined and conflated with marijuana on the Controlled Substances Act, and has been treated as a Schedule I drug since that time. So, as you know, industrial hemp. This is a little cartoon put together by Rick Friday out of Iowa. The world's standard fiber, but it's found in contempt due to its psychoactive cousin. We've talked about a lot the conflation of the separating the world of industrial hemp from marijuana. Scientifically, they're all cannabis sativa. What delineates the two worlds is the amount of THC that is in the plant. If you're below 0.3% THC, you're considered industrial hemp, and if you're above, you're considered marijuana. And that's the way they're regulated, you know, at all the state levels and globally, for the most part, based on that level. But because of the conflation of the two in the Controlled Substances Act of 1970, it's become nearly impossible. I would say I always felt like I'd won an argument when I could go into a room and talk about hemp, and somebody wouldn't snicker and say, "Well, when I talk about, well, you can make curtains or rugs or something for your household," and somebody would say, "Well, can I smoke my drapes?" You know, that was always the standard question: "Can I smoke my drapes?" When I got to the point where that question stopped being asked, you knew we were finally, you know, kind of breaking through and making some serious headway on what we were doing. What happened here then from a policy perspective is that in June of 2013, just again on the heels of Colorado legalizing, Washington State had legalized, and there was a number of states preparing to legalize in 2013. There was an attempt in the Senate by Senator Ron Wyden to deschedule hemp. And so he introduced the Industrial Hemp Farming Act of 2013, and it went down in the Senate in flames, about 85 to 15, I believe, was. This was the second week in June. And so it was a signal, really, from the Senate that there was really no appetite for any conversation around hemp. A week later, I was determined that we were going to try to get something in this farm bill, open the door somehow, so we could get the horse's nose out of the barn, at least. I authored what has now become Section 7606 of the Farm Bill, and took it to Congressman Jared Polis in the House and asked him if he would introduce it. And he did, and it became Polis Amendment 192, and then became part of the House language that went to conference in December. When it was in conference, I'm going to back up just one step. Once the bill was passed, it passed late in the evening in late June. As I was walking out of the House gallery that night after the debate, I looked up and, you know, the flag was flying over the chambers, they do when they're in session, and I thought, wait a minute, I'd had a flag made for the congressman, so he had something he could have in his hand when he was doing the House debate. I thought, we have a hemp flag, and we're just about to July 4th. I wonder if the Capitol Architect's office would fly this flag for us so we could make a story out of this. So the next day, we went to the architect's office, and sure enough, they said we would absolutely do that. And we kept it very quiet, so the news didn't break until after the flag had flown. But it was a media sensation for about a day. It was good, and so we were just trying to build a story. We were trying to build an awareness of what it was and what it wasn't. Later that fall in November, DEA Administrator Michelle Leonhardt was at a National Sheriff's Office, or National Sheriff's Convention in Boston, and announced in her speech that on the morning of July 13th, when she woke up and read that there was a hemp flag flying over the Capitol, it was the worst day of her 33-year career at DEA. She said that she was against all illegal drugs, even the flag-making kind. So it gives you a sense of where we've come from, really just in 5 years, from one state taking a stand and putting it in its constitution to allow its farmers to grow it, to statements like this from the DEA, to today where we're looking at fully 40 states who have legalized. We're really on the cusp of of building an industry and building some opportunity. Later that year, then in December, in the conference committee, that language did survive. In fact, they even expanded the language slightly to include specifically state departments of agriculture could enter into the research as well, and anybody with a permitted program. So, in January of 14, when the Farm Bill was signed, Section 7606 became the law of the land. And what it does allow is that any state where it's legal and where there's a permit process in place and there's oversight by either a state department of agriculture or a land-grant university, you are allowed to grow hemp for research and commercial purposes. Last year, Colorado was we've been the number one state since the beginning. A year ago, Colorado grew more hemp than all the other states combined. That is not going to be the case this year, I know. We've had some states like Montana that came right out of the gate this year with 22,000 acres. I think we had 30,000-ish acres in Colorado last year. We're probably going to have 35 or 40 this year. But Montana, Wisconsin, and Minnesota are really gearing up. There's a lot of states that are really starting to bring this in play. This is a picture of a John Deere W660 harvesting a hemp crop in Europe. As you can see in this case, these are males, and this, they're harvesting the seed across the top, put it in the bin, and then they'll field bred the stocks where they can be able to convert those to textiles and herd and a number of value-added products. And then over the walkers, you'll have generally the leaves that are pretty high in CBD, and just a third rail here for another value-added opportunity. In May, after we flew the flag that year, we went to Charlottesville and held a whole day of really just an education and a media event at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. Willie happened to be in town that night, and we happened to have the flag with us, so we ended up with the concert that evening. But really, this has been part of this has been, in the chain of events here is. When you get from advocacy and you try to find high-profile events and you bring media to it and you bring attention to the opportunity, and in that phase you generally have a lot of very passionate advocates. In this particular case, we have a lot of, the hippie culture, we'll call it. I don't mean that negative. It's the hippie culture that has been here all along and is very passionate about this plant and what it can do across the full spectrum. And the challenges that I think the industry is having from a media and public perception perspective is now how do we move this into your mainstream? How are we going to get farmers to grow this? How do we look at this from the economic perspective and not just the fact that we're trying to right a wrong and trying to stick it to the man, as they would say, that made this illegal a long time ago. So as you can see, there's this plant. Many claims will say there's 25,000 uses for this plant. I call it food, feed, fuel, fiber, and pharma. Pharma with an F. The biggest sector of the hemp production right now is CBD oils, full spectrum extraction, that is allowed under 7606. It's a very popular. Health-related product that people take. The nice thing about part of the market in the United States right now, whether it be for CBD oil or anything else, is that the United States today is still the largest consumer market for industrial hemp products in the world, and we still remain the only G7 nation that doesn't allow its cultivation under federal law. Now, the nuance is we have the Farm Bill that is allowing these projects to happen state by state. But under federal law, under a competing Controlled Substances Act, we are still, in Jeff Sessions' eyes, a Schedule I drug that is operating in violation of the Controlled Substances Act. But as you can see, this plant has these subcomponents can be so many different things. And which I think is the plus for the farmer and just adding to the diversity and the opportunities that you have, to the extent you have infrastructure, that you can take all of that plant and turn it, you know, into something. There was an old slogan in the pork industry once not long ago. We sell everything but the squeal, and that's about what we do with this plant. There's something pretty valuable in every component of this plant. This is just a picture of the Marijuana Tax Act in 1937. The stamps, first man arrested for growing it without a stamp. He actually happened to be a Coloradan, and we planted an 80th anniversary plot in a prairie bottom. It was planted on August 2nd, late by design, but only just to commemorate the fact that it had been 80 years since FDR had signed this bill, and we were really on the cusp of what we think is a new opportunity, in particular in Colorado and in our region. This is just a picture of a few of the things that you can find today. The hemp seed, the hemp hearts. Once you get beyond the CBD oil market, I'd say the hemp hearts is probably the most popular market right now. The farmers that grew in Minnesota this past year, most of them ended up growing for that seed market. The seed is identical in its omega profile to fish oils. So as we look at the kind of the collapsing fisheries in the ocean and being driven a lot by the insatiable world demand for fish oil, we have a land-based opportunity for some of that. Now, part of that's trying to figure out how we get everybody to work together on you know, displacing one industry for another. But the omega profiles are identical to fish. The hemp proteins, the hemp cake that's left over after the cold press of the seeds for the hemp oil, is extremely high in protein. We're doing some animal feed products, some animal feed tests in Colorado. Right now, under commission, we put together under our last legislature in Colorado. I mentioned to someone earlier that I've had a handful of discussions with a large organic grocery chain whose customers are consistently now asking for hemp-fed eggs, hemp-fed meat, hemp-fed X, fill in the blank. So we're in that stage where there's starting to become enough consumer awareness that the demand is starting to trickle up and they're asking for things that the market doesn't have right now. You know, before 1937, most of us got our cannabinoids and the things that come along. Our body has an endocannabinoid system that's really designed to and needs cannabinoids for to create a lot of homeostasis in our body. Prior to 1937, almost all of the pharmaceutical, anything you would have gotten at the local drugstore would have had some of that in it, because there was a lot of those extractions prior to that came from the cannabis plant. So we've had about 80 years where our bodies have been basically void of consuming and the cannabinoids up until today. And these are just a few of the products now where you can take the CBD, and then they're even it's even moved into the animal sector right now. It's very good for joints, just overall health. And that particular industry right now is expected to be, I think, $600 million this year of just domestic production. And it's about an $800 million market overall, just in the United States. So we have a market, we have a growing demand on this. And I think for me, one of the most exciting things I see locally, and it's not even, I wouldn't even call it anecdotal anymore, is that this crop and this particular section of you know, portion of growing is attracting the young people back. You know, it's fun to grow. It's got a great story. And a lot of these are tailored to smaller grows. You know, if you have 20 or 40 acres that you can devote to this, you know, you can make a good living right now with just CBD production. So I'm seeing a lot of interest, and particularly in Colorado, we have seen a flood of young people come back that want to be a part of this industry, and it's a really very exciting and very energetic audience we have there. And so it, this is just, this is from an old slide, but in the upper left, Ambassador James Woolsey, who I've got to know first through the 25 by 25 campaign, is one of our staunchest hemp advocates. And Jim got interested in hemp to begin with from the fuel side, because of the ability to produce copious amounts of ethanol and methanol from its stocks. He has always felt like that the hemp plant should have been should be one of our crop options for particularly low carbon biofuels. In the lower left, Senator Mitch McConnell has been a real champion for us. I'd say politically, this really isn't a contentious issue on Congress. Wherever you are in the political, ideological scale or divide, the people supporting this there's a little something in here for everybody. Either you're doing it for social justice reasons, you're doing it for rural economic development reasons, but we have a broad range of support. Both McConnell in the House and then Bob Goodlatte, or I'm in the Senate, Congressman Bob Goodlatte in the House, which is one of our great success stories. 3 years ago, the congressman was really, he was an anti-hemp man. He didn't think it should be legalized, wasn't interested in supporting it. But 7606 was the law of the land. The Virginia universities had put out 5 plots and grown them over that summer, and then had field days and brought him to the field days where they were filled with farmers who wanted to know how we could grow this. So the congressman over a very short period of time went from one of our largest foes to one of our greatest supporters. In fact, he introduced the House bill, the latest version of the Industrial Hemp Farming Act, in the House as Judiciary Chairman. So we'd come a long ways with him. And so just great stories all around on the spectrum of who's supporting this and who isn't. This is a shot from some veterans in Detroit who are interested in using hemp and hempcrete, which is a really interesting and old but new building product, and looking at the opportunities to do some reconstruction in parts of Detroit. We had some time with them about a month ago, and LA Trade Tech on the other end of the country, a Latino-based group there, supported by Dolores Huerta, is looking at doing designs of hemp tiny homes and trying to figure out how to build the homes in the LA area that can be that are reasonably priced and workers can afford, using hempcrete as the base product. So that is a sunset in eastern Colorado, and that's a male plant and seeds. And with that, I'll finish mine and we'll sit down and I guess we're ready for questions.
Hi there, Spencer Chase with AgriPulse. Michael, I'm going to do something out of character and engage in a little bit of ambush journalism on you.
Yeah.
Because shortly before you started talking, actually, Jeff Sessions announced his resignation. And so, your reaction to that from the perspective of someone promoting the hemp industry?
Well, it's nothing personal with me with Jeff, but Jeff has been not a friend of the industry, and even in his home state of Alabama, which has been legal for 2 years now and passed unanimously in both chambers, is still struggling to get a permit system in place. So his home state, and I understand they're going to have that permit system, they think, ready and be able to let growers grow in 2019, but from our perspective, having Jeff gone is a good thing. He was just, I spoke earlier that this is a lot of generational issue. You know, young people, millennials, roll their eyes and like, oh, really, we're still arguing over this? And then somebody my age who with just a little bit of information goes, yeah, we really need to just go back to what worked. And then, but it's like Jeff's generation and my parents' generation, who have had a real problem with this a lot because it's conflated with marijuana, and they believe it's the same thing, and they've believed it all their life, and they just it's just hard for them to change, and I understand that. I saw the energy it took to get my parents on board, and now they're using the CBD oil, and they love what it's doing for a number of their maladies, but this is just it's hard, and we've got a lot of work to do yet, and I'm wish Mr. Sessions the best.
But I mean, did your job get easier with that news? Because I imagine his replacement will be of the same or a similar generation, possibly mindset as he.
Well, I would. I guess I'll hold judgment to see who his replacement is. I can tell you that the signals we're getting from the White House is that the White House is in our camp on this, and the president campaigned that this is and should be a state issue, and I think he's held true to that. Where the pushback has not been coming from him, but Mr. Sessions has made several statements that the White House didn't push back on, of course, but given that there was really two channels of information coming from there, we were always more concerned with Mr. Sessions' position than the White House's.
Mm-hmm. Alan Watts from Kentucky. Of course, Senator McConnell's been a real champion for you guys, Congressman James Comer as well.
Yeah.
What do you see happening if this language stays in the Farm Bill, which both are saying it probably is going to stay in the Farm Bill? What will that do to the industrial hemp industry after that comes out in the new Farm Bill, whenever it's signed?
Well, the language in the new Farm Bill would deschedule hemp, and so it will be treated as an agricultural crop just like anything else, but with a caveat that there'll still be a permitting process required. So if you're in a state where there's already a lot of activity going on, like Kentucky and Colorado and many others, pretty much nothing's gonna change. What will change is if you're in a state that isn't legal, and your state doesn't legalize, there will be a track where USDA will have resources, and you'll be able to grow under a federal permit with some oversight by somebody. I don't know if it's going to be the local FSA or how they're going to manage that, but it's just really descheduling, opening up the door, and taking it back to what it should have always been. This is an agricultural crop.
Let me follow up on that real quickly. Recently in our community, we had a company, Vertical Hemp, came in. They purchased a building without any economic assistance, and they didn't ask for a thing. They came into the community. It's a $5 million investment. They bought a farmer's entire crop of industrial hemp to make CBD oils. Once this passes in the Farm Bill, do you see more of that happening, that industry really taking off to produce the oils and other thing products out of here?
That is the CBD extract, the whole plant extraction, the CBD oils is probably the most exciting and the most profitable part of this right now, and it's what we have and what works. So yes, I think we're going to see a lot of that. We've had some stops and starts along the way, in part because of the nobody knowing the position of the DOJ, and kind of deferring to the DEA, what they considered was legal and what was illegal. So we've had some matchups between Senator McConnell, who's very much in our camp, and DEA's positions, and we've won every one of them, but they have, the DOJ took somewhat of a hands-off approach to DEA as they were interfering with commerce. And but I think most of that's been cleared up, and I do think we're gonna see a lot of that. There is the demand curve on this is growing rapidly, as it is in China as well. Now, China has just announced, I'd have to look at the link, I saw it this week, but they've announced that, you know, in the next, by 2020, they're making significant new investments in their industrial hemp sector too, because they see where things are going. I had a conversation with folks from Mexico yesterday who are saying, how do we do this now that the Mexican Supreme Court has kind of opened the door on a few things and Canada's fully legalized? So we've got an opportunity to I think we're well positioned yet to lead here in the country. I think CBD oil is going to lead a lot of it, but very quickly we're going to see textiles, we're going to see, I think, biocomposites from the herd, bedding materials, the protein cake as an animal feed. I think it's going to become very popular. There's some Australian studies that show, particularly with chickens, that higher, you know, higher performance, lower mortalities with that. So I'm really excited about it. I kind of like this stuff anyway, but I think this is a legitimate alternative crop and specialty or whatever. I mean, potatoes are a specialty crop, so this isn't, you know, much different than that. But I do think that we've got a really significant opportunity in front of American agriculture right now.
Jim Dewey from Illinois and Missouri. And Dr. Myers, what is the holdup in farmers adding cover crops? It seems like everywhere we read about it and see about it, it's a really great thing, but so few are actually using it.
Yeah, we surveyed farmers about that in this National Cover Crop Farmer Survey, and the number one thing that they would cite is the time to plant the cover crop in the fall. So they feel they're too busy from fall harvest and other fall operations, whether that's tillage or fertility. So I think there's two solutions to that. One is that we're seeing more innovation with equipment manufacturers to help farmers put on a cover crop with equipment operations they're already doing, such as vertical tillage passes in the fall. You'll get a cover crop broadcast seeder right on that vertical tillage tool. So you're doing the cover crop seeding at the same time you're doing tillage you would otherwise do, or you're spreading it in mixed with fertilizer. The second solution is for our ag retailers to provide more services to seed cover crops, and some indeed are starting to do that. They're using their broadcast fertilizer equipment or high clearance spray equipment and adapting it to seed cover crops, in some cases into corn and soybeans before harvest, so that the cover crops can get an early start. So I think that particular issue will be overcome and is starting to be overcome, that time to seed it. The second biggest barrier is uncertainty about how it will affect spring planting. You know, they don't want anything to get in the way of spring planting, but fortunately we can deal with that with either cover crops that kill in the winter and just are out of the way, or just better education on the management steps. But so those are the two top things, and then obviously we've got to show farmers this economically does pay for itself. And if they're getting incentive payments, which many are, although not all, less than half get incentive payments, that quickly pays for itself. If they're not getting assistance from state or federal, then they're either making money in year one by grazing it, or by year two or three, it's starting to pay for itself just in terms of slight yield increases and potentially lower input costs.
Hi, I'm Jessica with the Texas Farm Bureau Radio Network. One of the problems we've had in Texas with specialty crops is a lack of infrastructure and processing plants. For example, people grow sesame. It has to be transported to a specific plant. We have one down in the valley. For some of our farmers, that's a pretty long trip. We have green bean farmers in the Panhandle who have to harvest at midnight so that the beans are still cold by the time they get down to South Texas. Is there a better way that we can address these needs so that farmers can still grow specialty crops like hemp, if it's ever allowed in Texas, and get them to these infrastructure places in a timely manner? Will we ever see that infrastructure grow?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it is a big problem for any type of alternative crop. Michael, you may want to comment on it too, but I've seen that time and time again. Distance to market is a major limitation, especially if it's not an extremely high valuable crop or one that is not perishable that could be transported a distance. So the way we've gotten past that is to work with existing processors. So to get grain elevator networks, for example, to devote a small bin to something like sesame. I've had some success with that, for example, with canola and sunflowers in Missouri in the past, but it becomes a challenge because that grain elevator might do it for a year or two, and then they decide, well, that wasn't quite enough business, so we're not going to do that anymore. So it's a persistent effort. We need farmers to be organized and say to their local delivery points, we want that assistance. But what would you say from the hemp side?
A couple of things. I know that this has come up in Arizona and the cotton areas of Arizona, and it would apply to Texas as well, that the cotton gins could process the hemp seed. And I think if we think more globally as farmers, if I'm a cotton farmer, that I'm a fiber farmer, not a cotton farmer. If I'm a soybean farmer, I'm a protein farmer, not a, you know, not just a soybean farmer. Kind of open up those options of integrating this into your plant mix, and in the places where you have cold press places to press the oil already in the infrastructure would be kind of a next logical step in regions where you have that. We've got a lot of infrastructure to put in place, and I'm convinced we're gonna do it. There's too many people that are on the cusp of this, but right now it's what do we have and what can we use with what we have to try to get us to the next step. And I think that's those cotton gins are probably the answer for part of it.
One more question.
Doug Edge with Farm Journal Broadcasting. Quick kind of follow-up, really, to your discussion there. You're talking more on the infrastructure, you know, from a, you know, what happens once it gets out of the field. But have you done any analysis or is there any information, particularly on the hemp side, of what it would cost a traditional corn, soybean, row crop farmer to convert to growing hemp? Is there any analysis on that?
Well, what we're seeing right now is the farmers that are growing for seed are using just some slightly modified wheat heads, and that's working pretty well for them, so there's not a lot of cost to go to that point. In the slide I showed where they're trying to take the entirety of it, you know, that investment's going to have to be that dual head. I mean, the standard combine will work for everything, you know, for it, but you're going to need that investment. So we're going to have to find ways to probably cooperatively own a few of those in regions, or find some unique ways to do custom work, possibly. But that's that next step is going to be in the harvesting, generally the harvesting equipment, and then the biggest, I think the biggest jump in investment is going to be when we look at the textile and the herd separation. The corticacean machines can be, you know, $50,000 to $100,000 for some pretty significant output. But textile, in one case, there's a South Korean technology right now that's looking to place itself in the United States. It's about a $30 million installation. It's going to need 16,000 acres of hemp to supply it, but it would employ about 900 people year-round. So if we look at kind of opportunities for those kinds of employments, those aren't big numbers. That isn't a big number when you think of that, of the economic multiplier in an area where you have government programs to assist in building that infrastructure.
Great questions. I almost hate to interrupt, but we are past our time limit, so we will go ahead and call it a session. And I'm sure these two gentlemen will be around for anybody who